Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. We finally finished the Samadhitti Sutta last week, and now we will take a very short sutta called the Shorter Discourse on the Lion's Roar. This is the Chula Sihanada Sutta, Sutta number 11 in the Majjhima Nikaya. Okay, this metaphor of a lion's roar is used to mean a kind of roar of triumph, a roar of victory. And usually the lion's roar is ascribed to the Buddha. It's when the Buddha makes a claim that is considered earth-shattering, monumental, of great importance. This is called the Buddha's lion's roar. But disciples also sometimes make claims, statements of great importance. And those claims too can be called lion's roars. And such statements are described in this way because in the jungle, when the lion comes out of its cave, stretches itself, and then utters a roar, then the sounds of all of the other animals are drowned out, and only the roar of the lion can be heard. And then all of the other animals, when they hear the lion's roar, they all become frightened, and they all run in different directions. Those animals that live in the ground, they run into their holes and seek safety in the ground. The birds fly into the air. The animals that dwell on the land run away far from the direction in which the lion's roar is coming. And it said even the elephants, which are kept in the cities and towns, even the elephants become frightened. And some of them, which are bound to strong posts, start trembling and shaking and pull up their posts or break their strong fetters. Okay, so the Buddha uses this image of the lion's roar in relation to his own important monumental claims and also in relation to the claims made by his disciples. And so this sutta that we're coming to now is a discourse in which the lion's roar is to be uttered by disciples. But it is the way in which the Buddha instructs disciples how they can roar their lion's roar. Okay, the sutta opens on an occasion when the Buddha is living in the Anathapindika's monastery near the city of Savatthi. And the Buddha addresses the monks and says, Bhikkhus, only here is there a recluse, an ascetic, only here a second recluse, only here a third recluse, only here a fourth recluse. The doctrines of others, that's the sects of others, the religious disciplines of others are devoid of recluses. That is how you should rightly roar your lion's roar. Okay, now if one takes this statement and looks at it, especially against our own background of which encourages tolerance, openness, kind of liberal attitude towards all religions, it seems rather closed, narrow-minded, boastful. But we have to understand, what is the statement being made here? Okay, what is meant by a recluse here? Here, the word recluse, the Pali word is samana, but the word is being used in a special sense to refer to one who has reached the attainment of stream entry, sotapanna. A second recluse means one who has reached the second stage of enlightenment, that is a once-returner. A third recluse is one who has reached the third stage of enlightenment, the stage of non-returner. And a fourth recluse is one who has reached the fourth stage, the stage of arahant. So when it's said that the doctrines of others, the other religious schools, are devoid of recluses, it doesn't necessarily mean that they are devoid of saintly people, devout people, people who are practicing with sincerity and earnestness and who might have reached certain high stages of realization, certain stages of saintly attainment. But what it means is that they have not reached any of these specific stages of realization which confer liberation from the cycle of repeated existence, from the cycle of rebirths. And the question is going to come up, what specifically is it that is necessary to gain this liberation from the cycle of repeated existence? What is it that distinguishes the Buddha's teaching from all these other spiritual teachings and makes it such a distinctive path to liberation? And that it will be the theme of this sutta. Okay, now after the Buddha teaches the monks that they can make this lion's roar, he says, now we come into paragraph 3, it is possible that the wanderers of other sects might ask you, on the strength of what argument or what the support of what authority you say this. So what is your confidence? What is your strength on the basis of which you say this? Okay, then the Buddha says, This is the answer that you should give. Four things have been declared to us by the Blessed One who knows and sees, the Worthy One, the Fully Enlightened One. On seeing these in ourselves, we say this. Okay, what are these four things? We have confidence in the teacher being the Buddha. We have confidence in the Dhamma. We have fulfilled the precepts, the virtues, and our companions in the Dhamma are dear and agreeable to us, whether they are lay people or those gone forth. Okay, so these are the four things that the Buddha has declared to us, and we see these in ourselves, and on this basis, we make this statement. Okay, this is now an imaginary debate or dialogue is being constructed here between the monks and the wanderers of other sects. So the Buddha continues, "It is possible when you speak thus that the wanderers of other sects might say," in other words, the wanderers of other sects are not simply going to accept this for an answer and say, "Okay, that's all right, we agree," and then turn around and go back to their parks. But they will continue the debate and go on and try to push their point. And so they'll say, "What is there especially unique about your claim? Because we also have confidence in the teacher, the master, but not in Gotama, not in the Venerable Gotama, but we have confidence in our teacher." Whoever that teacher might be, one will have confidence in Sanjaya Belatiputta, another confidence in Mukli Gosala, another confidence in Nigantanatha Putta. These are some of the great spiritual teachers of the time. We too have confidence in the Dhamma. The Dhamma was not a unique term used in relation to the Buddha's teaching, but every teacher called his doctrine the Dhamma. So these wanderers say, "We have confidence in the Dhamma," that is, in our Dhamma. Then they say, "We too have fulfilled the precepts," not your precepts, but our precepts. "And our companions in the Dhamma," that is, our spiritual friends, "are dear and agreeable to us, both the lay people and those gone forth." Okay, so what is the distinction? What is the difference between you and us? In other words, the four points that you mention don't seem to be adequate for drawing any distinction between you and us, and for you to say, "We have these four types of holy or saintly people in our sect, and you don't have the four types of saintly or enlightened people in your sect." Okay, so now in the next section, we see the terms of the debate are going to be defined more precisely. Okay, when the wanderers of other sects speak thus, then you should answer them in this way. How is it, friends? Is the goal one or many? Okay, if they are answering correctly, they would say that the goal is one, not many. Okay, so once they agree that the goal is one, now we're going to see what are the qualifications necessary in a person to attain that goal. Okay, can that goal be attained by one who is subject to lust? Or to attain it, does one have to be free from lust? Okay, answering rightly, they would have to answer thus, that this goal is for one who is free from lust, not for one who is still subject to lust. Is that goal for one subject to hate or free from hate? Answering rightly, the goal is for one who is free from hate. Is that goal for one who is subject to delusion or for one free from delusion? Answering rightly, they would have to say that the goal is for one who is free from delusion. Okay, so at this point, the Buddha, or we can say the monks, engaged in this debate with the wanderers from the other sects, would have to have established in common with the wanderers of other sects, that the goal is for one who is free from the three unwholesome roots, the unwholesome roots of greed or lust, hatred and delusion. And this would be a kind of big concession on the point, on a big concession on the part of the other party, because there would be maybe some parties to a debate like this who would think that the goal might be to be reborn in a type of heavenly world in which one would be enjoying divine sense pleasures. In that case, if one examines very closely, one would see that the goal is, their goal is not for one who is free from lust, because there is still, if you see that their goal is to be reborn in a celestial world and enjoy divine or heavenly sense pleasures, one sees that there is still some lingering type of lust there. I think if one were to engage in debate with many religious followers today, not speaking about the Buddha's time, and ask whether the goal is for one free from hatred or not, one would see that many contemporary religions would not agree that the goal is for one who is free from hatred. But they seem to think that the goal of their goal is for one who even has such strong hatred that they would be willing to sacrifice their life for the cause of that religion in a spirit of intense hatred, of vengeance, retaliation. Okay, this unwholesome root of delusion is very difficult to detect, and everybody denies that they have delusion. But we have to find out later, we will see, what is the real distinguishing characteristic of delusion. Okay, is that goal for one subject to craving or free from craving? For one subject to clinging or free from clinging? this really seems to be just giving synonyms for lust. So it's not really adding anything new, but just exploring the same idea in terms of synonyms. And is the goal for one who has vision or for one without vision? Again, this is a variation on the idea of whether the goal is for one with delusion or one without delusion. The next criterion is an interesting one. Is the goal for one, it's translated, is the goal for one who favors and opposes, or for one who does not favor and oppose? What is meant here by favoring and opposing, in Pali it would be anurodha pativirodha, for one who has attachment and aversion, or one who is free from attachment and aversion. Again, this is trying to determine whether the goal is for one. This criterion is trying to determine whether equanimity is a criterion of the person who has achieved the goal. Because what's meant by favoring and opposing is liking what is pleasant and disliking what is unpleasant, or having approving of those people who are agreeable to oneself, disapproving of those who are disagreeable, or having an inclination towards pleasant forms, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile objects, and having an aversion towards disagreeable forms, sounds, smells, tastes, and tactile objects. Okay, so one who has a liking and disliking for what is pleasant and unpleasant is one who does not have well-established equanimity. And so that would not be a mark of one who has achieved the goal. But one who has achieved the goal, that is, this one goal, would be one who has gone beyond this favoring and opposing, one established in equanimity. Okay, the next criterion, I have to say, would be rather, it uses a rather obscure term, and I just don't know how this term would have been understood in a discussion between Buddhists and non-Buddhists, or rather I would say that it is interesting that the term should have been understood in common between Buddhists and non-Buddhists in a discussion, which seems to suggest that this term was not uniquely coined by the Buddha, but must have been part of the shared vocabulary amongst the spiritual communities of that time. This term, which is translated here as proliferation, is the Pali word papancha. Yeah, the commentary to the Majjhima Nikaya says that papancha here means mental activity governed by craving and views. But that seems to be, to me, this seems to be a very specifically Buddhist understanding of papancha. And so it seems to me unlikely that that could have been an understanding of the word papancha that would have been understood in common in a discussion between Buddhists and non-Buddhists. It seems to me more likely that papancha would have had another meaning. And from a number of different contexts, as the word papancha is used in the early suttas, I have the impression that papancha simply has a meaning, the sense of, we can call it the diversity and multiplicity of the world, the differentiation of the world. And if we take that understanding, then I think this would make sense as a meaning of the word in a discussion between Buddhists and followers of other systems of thought, since we could see them coming to an agreement that the goal of spiritual endeavor is for one who does not delight in and enjoy the diversity, the multiplicity, the differentiation of the world, but is rather for one who does not delight in and enjoy this multiplicity, this diversity, this differentiation of the world. Okay, before I go further, I'll just ask, does anybody have any questions about anything just that needs to be cleared up here in these terms? I don't want to go off the track of the sutta, but anything need clarification?
Could you please explain more about what is wrong with diversity, multiplicity, differentiation of the world?
Well, this seems to have been a common understanding. For the recorder, he asked, would I please explain what is wrong with the multiplicity, diversity of the world? It was just a common understanding amongst the spiritual seekers of the period that the multiplicity, diversity of the world was something that entangled one in craving, in clinging, and that bound one up in a variety of sensory perceptions, sensory experience, and thereby prevented one from gaining that inner unification that was a necessary foundation for realizing that transcendental reality, that transcendental experience. Okay, at this point now, the debate or the discussion has now come to an end, and now the Buddha introduces a new theme, which he is going to develop in such a way as to show that the ascetics that have been engaging in this discussion might not be those who are free from all of these faults, who are not free from lust, hatred, delusion, and so on. So he's setting up now a certain standard by which we can determine whether the the wanderers of other sects who are engaging in this discussion are actually free from lust, hatred, and delusion as they believe themselves to be. And this standard revolves around their relationship to certain philosophical views. Here, the views, up to this point, the views have been kept in the background. But now the actual content of the views to which these wanderers of other sects might be adhering, the content of the view is now brought out into the open. So the Buddha says that there are these two views. What are these two views? In the sutta, they are called bhavaditti and vibhavaditti, the view of being or the view of existence, and the view of non-being, the view of non-existence. Now, the view of being is also called the eternalist view. It's identical with the eternalist view. This is the view, basically, that in some way or another, in some form or another, the self and the world are eternal. Particularly, it's the view that the person has some individual self which is permanent, eternal, unchanging. And that permanent self exists in relation to an everlasting world. What's called the view of non-being is also known as the annihilationist view. And this is the view that the person, the self, with the breakup of the body, comes to an end and doesn't survive in any way after death. In other words, it's the view of a kind of temporary self which is annihilated and extinguished at death without any continuation of the stream of consciousness, without any continuation of our karmic actions producing effects within our individual stream of consciousness. Now, this just means the view of existence is the same as eternalism. The view of non-existence is the same as annihilationism. Now, there's a sutta in which the Buddha has taken a survey of all the views that were current in the India of his time, or at least in the part of India in which he was living. This is called the Brahmajala Sutta, the discourse on the all-embracing net of views. And the Buddha has classified all of these views into 62 categories. And then at the end of the sutta, he reduces all of these 62 views to the, I think the, maybe there's a commentary who does this, reduces all of the 62 views to the two categories of eternalism and annihilationism. And then the Buddha points out that his own teaching is distinct from these two doctrines of eternalism and annihilationism. Okay, then the Buddha says that any recluses or Brahmins who rely on the view of being, who adopt the view of being, who accept the view of being, are opposed to the view of non-being. Any recluses or ascetics or Brahmins who rely on the view of non-being, who adopt the view of non-being, accept the view of non-being, are opposed to the view of being. And when he says that one who accepts one view is opposed to the other view, this means that one who accepts one of these views falls into favoring and opposing, because by favoring the view of being, then one is opposed to the view of non-being. So one has fallen into favoring and opposing. And if one adopts the view of non-being, one adopts annihilationism, then one is opposed to the view of being. So again, one has fallen into favoring and opposing. Of course, I don't know why the sectarians, the followers of other sects, say, well, Buddha, if you're not accepting either the view of being or the view of non-being, then you're opposed to both the view of being and non-being. So you have also fallen into favoring and opposing. But of course, this is a Buddha Sutta, so they wouldn't say that. Okay, now continuing, paragraph 7. Any recluses or Brahmins who do not understand as they actually are the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape in the case of these two views are, I don't like affected by, subject to lust, subject to hatred, subject to delusion, subject to craving, subject to clinging, without vision, given to favoring and opposing, and they delight in and enjoy proliferation. As I understand it, they delight in and enjoy this multiplicity and diversity of the world. They are not freed from birth, aging, and death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. They are not freed from suffering, I say. On the other hand, we'll just go to paragraph 8 and I'll come back and examine what is being said. Any recluses or Brahmins who understand as they actually are the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and escape in the case of these two views, the view of being, the view of non-being, they are without lust, without hate, without delusion, without craving, without clinging, with vision, that means they have wisdom, They are not given to favoring and opposing, and they do not delight in and enjoy proliferation. They are freed from birth, aging, and death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. They are freed from suffering, I say. Okay, so what's important here is understanding these five, we call these understanding the two types of views from these five perspectives. And in the suttas, if you look especially through the Samyutta Nikaya, one finds again and again that different phenomena are held up and examined from these five perspectives. Perspective of what is their origin, how do they originate, what is their disappearance, how do they cease, what is their gratification, that is, what is the pleasure and joy that comes from them, what is the danger in them, what is the escape from them. Okay, in the case of these two views, two types of views, one raises the question, what is the origin? How do these two views, types of views, originate? The commentary just gives a very general answer here. It just mentions eight conditions. If you look at the note on page 171, but I think a better way to understand the origin of these views is through, especially to emphasize the role of unwise attention, ayoniso manasikara, that is, you call it wrong reflection, careless consideration. Often it's influenced by bad friends who might have good intentions, but because they suggest to us to think incorrectly, then we call them bad friends. This unwise attention will be based in turn upon unexamined perception and thought amongst these eight conditions. We perceive things through in distorted ways. This is the working, the natural way in which the unenlightened mind works because of our perceptual apparatus functions in such a way that it is designed to aid our biological survival, not to assist our liberation from suffering. And so the perceptual apparatus works in such a way that it distorts the incoming data, or it processes incoming data in a way that doesn't represent those data in their actual mode of being as they truly are. And then based upon these distortions of perception, we think about things incorrectly, and then through linking together these incorrect thoughts, these foolish thoughts, we engage in a process of unwise reflection, and through unwise reflection, we arrive at these wrong views, the view of being, the view of non-being. And throughout history, these views, two types of views, the view of being, the view of non-being, have been so dominant, so widespread, that almost all human cultures, human civilizations, have been subject to them, have been indoctrinated by them, so that people almost from birth, through childhood, through their educational process, have been taught, usually they're taught through their childhood, through their educational process, taught one variant or another of the view of being, some type of eternalist view, but it's the radical, reflective type of people, the rebels against the established mainstream, who arrive at the view of non-being, the nihilists, the annihilationists, the existentialists, the anarchists, the deniers. So that takes some determined, decisive activity of thought, but wrong thought, to arrive at the view of non-being. But then in recent times, we've come to, again, whole cultures which have been governed by the view of non-being. The Soviet Union, up until the time of its collapse, governed by Marxism. So you're indoctrinated from the time you're a youngster. There is no God, no soul. Everything is just matter. No kind of spirit, no all of man's aspirations for eternity, for any kind of depth, for any kind of meaning, are all just illusions based upon a material foundation. When the body passes away, everything comes to an end. All art, religion, culture, just a mirage upon, built up upon the foundation of the forces of production. I don't remember my Communist Manifesto. It goes back many years. Okay, so this is how these views of being and non-being originate, and what lies beneath wrong perception, wrong thought, unwise attention, what is more fundamental as the origin of these wrong views, still more fundamental condition. Ignorance, right. Ignorance and also craving is there. Ignorance and craving work together. Usually there is the craving for being, the craving for existence lies at the root of the view of existence, the view of being, eternalist views. The craving for non-existence lies at the root of the view of non-existence. The view of non-existence is a rather strange type of view, since most people, it's not the typical type of craving. The sort of natural, deeply ingrained craving is the craving for existence. But this craving for non-existence seems to come, I'd say, in people perhaps who have been frustrated in their attempts at satisfaction, or people perhaps who reflect somewhat deeply on the human condition and see how all beings are subject to death, and then rather than grasp at some idea of eternal life or some continuation but beyond death, they simply come to the conclusion that death is the inevitable destiny of all life, and it's pointless to aspire for anything after death. And so then they grasp upon this idea that death is the end of everything, and they hold firmly to this idea. They cling to this idea. And then that becomes a kind of, on the one hand, it becomes a view. At the same time, it's a view that expresses a craving, a desire just simply to be annihilated at death and not to go on in any form. Okay, then the disappearance of these two views. Okay, the commentary says that the disappearance or the passing away, the cessation of the views is the attainment of the stage of stream entry. Because with the attainment of the stage of stream entry, one gets free from all views. The stream enterer is one who gives up all wrong views. But I'm wondering if the explanation in the commentary, whether it might not be too simple. One could say that the disappearance, if the origin of views is unwise attention, wrong thinking, wrong thoughts, perhaps one could say that the passing away of views comes through a process that involves correct perception, right thinking, wise attention, wise consideration, a number of factors. And so the attainment of the stage of stream entry would be just the culmination of the process. One just can't simply say the path of stream entry is the cessation of these two views. Okay, the gratification in these views, the gratification is the pleasure and enjoyment that holding to these views will give. And so those who adopt a view of existence usually get some kind of immediate pleasure and enjoyment. It gives a sense of relief that one has the satisfaction of thinking myself is eternal and everlasting. Those who adopt the view of non-existence, it seems somewhat more difficult to see how that view will give some gratification, doesn't it?
Well, you can do whatever you want and then have to pay for it after.
Oh, that's a good suggestion. One could do whatever one wants without having to pay for it. Yeah?
Well, there's also the gratification of knowing that anything there is to be seen, I have seen.
Anything there is to be seen, I have seen?
Yeah, so, you know, like the modern scientists feel.
Okay.
This is what we see, this is all there is. Say there's something else afterwards means that I haven't discovered it.
Anyway, there must come some gratification. Okay, the danger is that these views, whether of being or non-being, because they are incorrect views, do not allow one to understand things as they really are. And so by holding to either of these views, one remains, as this paragraph itself will say, by holding to either of these views, one remains bound to birth, aging, and death, to sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Okay, and the escape in the case of these two views, the commentary says the escape is nibbana. But I tend to take to understand the escape, nisarana, to be the way that leads out, and that I would take to be the Noble Eightfold Path, to lead out to nibbana. Okay, at this point we'll end the discussion, and next week we will finish the sutta. If there are any questions now or any comments, I don't hesitate to say that some points in the sutta are not completely clear to me. The way it's expressed is very concise, very telescoped. And so if anybody has any insights into it that they wish to share, please feel welcome to speak up. Yes, Janet? Yeah.
Going back to the very beginning of the sutta, there was the four things they start off with to say, for this you have a mind, you can do the lines more. The last one I'm not really clear on. It was the, our Dharma companions are near to us, whether they're laymen or whether they go forth. Is that just talking about, I mean, because I don't think it's equanimity, because we go into that later. That's why I'm wondering, is that just compassion or understanding? I'm just trying to understand that piece.
It's a good question. Let me repeat the question for the benefit of our little friends, our little mice here. She says that she doesn't understand at the close to the beginning of the sutta, where the wanderers bring up this point about that our companions in the Dhamma are dear and agreeable to us, whether they are lay people or those gone forth. How is this one of the guarantees, one of the supports for contending that only here there is a recluse? I have to say, to confess, I don't really see how very clearly myself how that supports the argument. Perhaps because any group of believers can say our religious friends are dear and agreeable to us, that doesn't prove that some amongst us are holy and enlightened people. Yeah.
Wasn't there another sutta we read where they were talking about how in other schools there's disagreement and debate within the school amongst the adherents?
That is a good point. Let me try to refresh my memory.
He was saying how here in this assembly no one coughs or makes a sound or interrupts their teacher.
Yeah, that's a good point. This would be Mahasakalu Dai Sutta, that's number 77. That's where the Buddha is trying to show how his disciples honor, respect, revere him.
So maybe this fourth thing is just saying, here we're all in agreement with each other. Here we don't argue amongst ourselves.
So it doesn't seem to be saying simply that there are no arguments amongst us. And I just want to see what words are used in the original text. Piya manapa sahadamika kopana. Piya manapa. It doesn't go so far as to say that there are no arguments. And I think that idea would have been expressed differently. So it does seem to be pointing out to a kind of harmony, that there's a kind of harmony.
We're all practicing rightly, maybe.
I think that would be expressed differently. I would say, in my opinion, not that I'm going to go back and try to correct the book, but he could have cited other ways to support the idea that here, only here, there is a recluse, a second, third, fourth recluse, that to my mind would have provided a sounder and stronger basis for the claim than stating that our companions in the Dhamma are dear and agreeable to us, which doesn't seem to go very far in support of that claim. There might be something behind that that I'm missing, that we're missing. Yes? To taking refuge. Does it refer to taking refuge in the Sangha?
Well, because we have refuge in the teacher and Dhamma.
It seems to be bringing in the Sangha aspect. Since so far we have teacher as Buddha, Dhamma, and then the precept sila would cover sikha, the training, one aspect of training. Then the fellows, the companions in Dhamma would be the Sangha aspect. I mean, that could be the case, but one still finds it difficult to see how that is supporting the claim. Again, it might be that this is a summary of a longer original discourse which would have made the point more clearly.
Maybe just, well, I don't know, but if the monks or disciples are dealing with you, that maybe they found peace within themselves.
Okay, his point is maybe they found peace within themselves so they could behave like that. I think there are fixed formulas for expressing the idea of people who have found peace within themselves. So if that was the point to be conveyed, one of those other formulas would be used rather than saying that our fellows are dear and agreeable to us. This seems to be, and I've looked at the Pali words, piya manapa, which are words used in everyday discourse that a father might say, my children are piya manapa in relation to myself. My children are dear and agreeable to me. So they're just very common, ordinary words that don't signify any kind of spiritual realization.
Doesn't it show that?
It might even be said that it shows attachment. Somebody might quote the Dhammapada, which says, there's a verse in the top, Dhammapada, from what is dear, piya, comes grief. From what is dear, comes fear. For one who has nothing that is dear, there is no grief. Whence then fear? Excuse me? Okay, maybe not. Yeah. In fact, I think you have a good point there. This probably At any rate, this establishes some four points of agreement, apparent agreement between the Buddha's school and the other schools. But it is true that the Buddha did say that the monk should present this as four supports for the claim that only here there is a recluse, a second recluse, third, fourth recluse. So,
I mean, if you look at the paragraph right after where it says, they'll come right back and say, well, we have confidence in our teacher too. I mean, none of the four points really support that claim.
Yeah.
It's the later parts of the sutta that support the claim.
Yeah. Okay, and I think we'll just leave this. Any other questions or... Okay, Peter?
I want to make a comment in reference to... He says, those who have the view of being are opposed to those who have the view of non-being and vice versa. And then he commented, why would the parents just come back and say, well, you're opposed to being and not being? And I think that's because the Buddha doesn't say he has a view that opposes being and non-being, but that he knows and sees. It's like when he spoke to the Brahmins and said, is there anyone who knows and sees things are true, or is it just a view you all have? No, they didn't claim that anybody knew and saw that. It was just their view. So.
Okay, that's a very good way to put that. Okay, very good. And Paul?
Yeah, is there an inherent problem with the view of eternalism, other than simply your non-self, that you have this eternal soul, that you can't escape samsara, you can't reach nirvana, because you have this soul that has to continue on? Is that a logic, a philosophical issue?
Okay, let me see if I understand the question. Is there anything inherently wrong with the view of eternalism?
Yeah, that's other than to not self, reaching nirvana.
So that the view of eternalism would be an obstruction to achieving nirvana? Okay, I think that what the Buddhists would say is that the view of eternalism would be correct insofar as it posits some kind of continuation beyond the death of the body. And that way it's superior to a nihilist view, which says that at death everything comes to an end, that there's no results of action. So eternalism would say that there is survival of bodily death, and one does receive the results of good and bad actions. So to that extent, one would say that the view is on the side of the wholesome. But insofar as the eternalism is positing an everlasting self, a substantial self, then it is preventing the correct view or the insight into impermanence, and then from impermanence, the view into dukkha and into anatta, into the unsatisfactoriness and into selflessness. And also eternalism would be contrary to the principle of conditionality, that everything arises through causes and conditions. So in that sense, the view of eternalism would be an obstruction to liberation. Though one does need the view that there is continuation beyond death in order to have the right view of the cause and effect of action. Okay, I think we'll have to stop for the evening and end with the sharing of the merits. Akasata cha bhumata deva nagamahitika punyantam anumodiva chirang rakantu sasanam akasata chabumata deva nagamahitika punyantam anumodiva chirang rakantu desanam akasata chabumata deva nagamahitika punyantam anumodiva chirang rakantu mam param etavata cham hehi sampadam punyasampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sata sabbe bhutanam sabba sampati siddhya etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.